Okay. Page 155. Relying on wealth. We all have a certain amount of wealth in this country. For this reason, every recess of our hearts must be continually scrutinized. It's the spiritual quandary, the spiritual situation where you're not sure, have I wisely provided for necessity, or have I gone beyond? It's the thinking about it that's important. It's when you decide, it's not important, I once and for all know that there is no limit to how much I need, because after all, the spiritual writers are telling me that you can't rely on wealth. Well, obviously, because you don't have enough of it. But if you had enough of it, you could rely on it. I mean, you know that. And so, obviously, I need to have as much as possible. And then I can rely on it. Then you give up. So the point is, we never should let ourselves get to the point where this is a done deal, settled issue. Okay, I know now I need to devote myself to the accumulation of more and more and more, because I've already been told that it will not provide me with security, so that means the door is open for an endless necessity of more and more. You see, because there is not a finite amount that will provide security, but an endless devotion to the accumulation will. You'll never be without if you devote yourself completely to this. And then what does that mean? Well, that means that you've decided that spiritual life is worthless. What is of really a value is material security. So that you're done. You know, you might as well be gone. You know, you've given up being a human being at that point. So my point is that we are supposed to be in a condition of considering it constantly, regularly. And sometimes we say, no, I really need to focus on strengthening what I have available to deal realistically with necessities, taking into account all of the things that could happen and the needs of my children and family and my community. So you do that work. But you do that work in a spirit of knowing that that's what you're doing, that you're providing for the necessity and no more. You don't sell your soul to the effort of unlimited more. The only way you could avoid that is by thinking about it regularly, constantly. That's my point. Every recess of our heart must be continually scrutinized.
What's scrutinized?
Examined very closely with questioning. Is this really the case? Do I really need this? Have I gone too far? Have I gone so far that I have no time left for spiritual life, and spiritual life is totally secondary? That's scrutinizing, looking at it with some scrutiny, with a close examination.
Rely on it, it makes you tend to not be as willing to give it away when somebody needs it.
Right.
So.
To know this is mine for my protection.
I may not have
justified.
Enough.
Yeah, I may not have enough for my needs. It's a very difficult thing to balance out and to not be in the state where you're actually, what you're doing is, your faith isn't in God anymore, your faith is in money.
I think it's
or your ability to work, or your ability to do, you know.
It's exactly the situation where you have to think about these things instead of just relying on wealth. That's the spiritual moment when you have to consider these things. Okay, continuing on page 155. Abba Moses teaches that anything accomplished for the sake of glory will eventually be consumed by the destructive power of other passions. The wisdom of this teaching is easy to see in our world. An endless parade of politicians, executives, and celebrities in the news every day remind us that wealth and power accumulated by people in love with human glory most often seem to be swallowed up and squandered eventually by the ever more questionable depths to which the same people find themselves sinking later on. We see the politician risking and destroying his successful career in order to have an affair, the famous musician wasting all her money on drugs and alcohol, the movie star divorcing for the seventh time, when pursued for worldly glory, even the material success we do accumulate is most likely to be swallowed up by our other demons. We were hearing, and you know, maybe you heard this with me, Sharon, I'm not sure where I heard this. It may have been something I was reading. Up to a certain point in our history, and we're, of course, we're old, so we span more than one generation, and we can remember the world being different than what it is. But the point that was being made as I was listening to or reading this material was that, say, in, I think, the 50s and the early 60s, up to that point, if you asked people what their ultimate life goals were, their life goals were to get married, to have children, to have a family, and to live their life in that kind of way. And starting in the late 60s, from the 70s especially, the 70s on, the goal that people started to have is fame and glory. It's really strange. You know, you didn't hear it with me, right? So I'm assuming I must have read it recently.
You must have read it recently.
Okay. So that the common goals today is not for a stable, normal life of relationships with other members of our family and people that we care for, take care of, and a community life. That was the old goal. But the new common goal today is the individual's desire to be known, to be recognized, to have our 15 minutes of fame, for people to know who we are. Goals have changed in our society today. That has now become a common goal.
Is that a consensus interview thing?
I don't know what you mean.
How did they come to this conclusion?
Asking,
yes, it was a poll. It was a poll that was taken.
Mm-hmm. See.
Polls that were taken in the olden days, when I was young, very young, in fact, you know, and more recently, the goals of people have changed.
Are the goals, are you saying?
Perhaps it could be because of fame and glory is like, that's what we have now. We have everybody, because of the broad communications, your televisions and radios and...
Lots of hits on the internet page.
You've
$10 million for throwing a baseball. A year.
Yeah.
Or more. You know, this is why people want to have fame and glory, you know.
If you want to be a god, instead of having the real god, you want to be god yourself. Where you'd go.
Yeah. So. To experience the idolation, other people idolizing you and saying that you're important and treating you as though you're special and different, that has become a much more common goal than it was at one time. And as a result, society is highly unstable. And it was much more stable when people's goals were to have family life, community life, connectedness with other people. Those desires fit in a lot better with traditional spiritual life. I mean, the other desire for fame and glory doesn't fit in at all. It just so things become worse and worse. And hey, some people now, you can become famous and everybody knows who you are by doing extremely terrible things. Mm-hmm. You don't even need to be a person of great accomplishments. Why work hard for 20 years to accomplish something worthwhile when you could be known in 24 hours by doing something awful? Just if your goal is fame and glory, it's a strange way to think, but common. It's become more common. Okay, as to work, the antidote to the problem of pursuing for worldly glory, material success, and then having it eaten up by all our demons. The antidote to that problem, according to Abba Moses, is once again discretion, the monitoring of which motivations drive what we do. This is something we can go over in our own mind and heart on a regular basis, on a daily basis even. We must purify these intentions of ours and carry out our work for the right reasons. Work is also in no way what defines a human being or gives life its purpose, as it is so often assumed in our world. Work is something that is done for survival, and it's a practical matter. It's not done for spiritual reasons of puffing ourselves up. It is not the point of our lives, even if our work involves contributing to the betterment of society. Nor is work for the saving of other people, nor for any other noble pursuit. It's a limited activity that is meant to be practical, not a major spiritual accomplishment to feed our vanity or something like that. One of the great temptations of Christians in our world is to accept the notion that what we do for work constitutes who we are, makes up who we are in some way. A notion, a way of thinking, that the world around us promotes endlessly. You are what you do, what you accomplish. For many Christians, this idea is the driving force behind choosing a line of work that is perceived to be noble or altruistic. So our work is noble or altruistic? That means we are noble or altruistic. Not necessarily. Our work could serve some good purpose that is noble, but what are we like ourselves? That's the question. The Christian becomes attracted to teaching, charities, medicine, other jobs seen to benefit the greater good. The way I always have put it to myself is that there are some things that are worth doing for themselves. There are some things that are of value, you know, to everyone. And I think that's true of the nature of work. And some things are. Other things are supportive, more or less. You know, I mean, every kind of work is involved with, you know, community life or, you know, in one way or another. But there are some things that are of value for their own sake. And I know they mentions a bunch of them. Things that are noble or altruistic. Teaching, charities, medicine, being a doctor, being a nurse. That's true. But while there is no reason whatsoever that Christians ought to actively avoid such work, we must also refrain from making the mistake of thinking that these kinds of employment are spiritually more healthy for us than other types. And so he's pointing out to me, Father Jacob, you are incorrect. You see that? If we see our work in this way, we are likely to be drawn into the kind of worldly motivations the fathers so explicitly, so clearly and intentionally teach against. Instead of seeming to be something that is required to sustain us, our work can start to appear to us to be a glorious contribution to the good of humanity. To work for this reason is to work for human glory. So he put me in my place. Are there things that are worth doing for themselves because they contribute in this way to human glory? Or he's saying no. That's not true. You are incorrect. It is more advisable for us to struggle in steadfast perseverance toward the minimal fruit of our solitude rather than to seek a bigger profit, which, even if arising from the most productive conversion of many people, is still eaten up by the needs of worldly affairs and the atrophy, that means the breaking down or the dying or lack of attention to cause something to die, arising from daily busyness. Not sure that was a clear paragraph. Could you restate that?
Atrophy of what was he?
Worldly affairs let our spiritual life atrophy because we're just daily so busy that we don't have time for spiritual life. That's how I would interpret it.
And we often feel that way. You know, I'm so busy I have to get up and go to work and then come home, don't have time to pray. And do this and do that. And I don't have time to pray. Yeah, or I don't have time to think about what's most important. Or even as a nurse, when I was working as a nurse, I was taking care of patients, and so lots of times the job itself required you to be so busy doing certain little prescribed tasks at certain times that often I would feel that I don't have time
for the patients even, yeah,
to interact with them.
That explained a lot. A lot of people get impatient with their nurses when they're patients sometimes.
Yeah, because they're out busy being professional nurses instead of taking care of patients.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
That might be why my sister's not a nurse anymore.
There are lots of reasons not to be a nurse. I think being a nurse is pretty frustrating and exhausting. If the perception that we are doing good for others causes us to become spiritually so embroiled or involved and deeply lost in our work, instead of cultivating detachment toward our work, then such perceived gains are not gains at all, but rather constitute serious loss for ourselves and even the church. I think there's a way of working where you can focus on the work and just do the work and not let yourself be motivated by some kind of delusions about what you're doing at this moment being so important that you don't have time to do anything else, like take care of patients. Again, I think there's a gear shifting problem here. You know, I mean, there are a lot of work that you do, you just kind of have to chip away at. You know, just keep chipping away at it and just do it, do the work, you know, and then sometimes something comes up. And if you can stop and without getting frustrated, switch into that other mode and go take care of patients and then come back. I mean, taking care of patients is what it's all about, frankly. The rest of your time you use in chipping away at the things that kind of never end, that always need to be done and may not get caught up ever, because they're just ongoing. But patients come and go. They come, they need to be taken care of while they're there, and they will be gone, and you might still be working on this endless kind of work that needs to be done, but really never will end. And you have to be able to interrupt that and go and take care of patients and for a time, and then when they've had their immediate need taken care of, you come back and do what you're... That, doing that, I think that's the most difficult thing about work, being able to do that. And the point is that if you have discernment and detachment, you will be able to do that. I think that's part of what that's about. From these observations about what work is for and not for, grow the Father's teachings on how work can be a spiritual tool in Christian life. It's going to teach you discernment. It's going to teach you detachment. Instead of just becoming a kind of a monster about it, you know, being so devoted to it that you ignore, you know, some of the more important things that have to do with your work. The most straightforward way the fathers of the conferences sought to make work beneficial was by incorporating prayer into their labor. In the 10th conference, Abba Isaac recommends a short, repetitive prayer that served as the most important predecessor to the modern Jesus prayer, with a basically identical function. And of course, when he says modern, he means later than the 4th century, 8th century, 9th century, you know. But so, because we're talking about really almost ancient Christian times here, at the beginning, right after the legalization of Christianity. Okay, and so what is that predecessor to the modern Jesus prayer? O God, make speed to save me. O Lord, make haste to help me. The words in this verse must be poured forth constantly, Abba Isaac says, that we may be guided through adversity and that we may be preserved in prosperity rather than becoming haughty. So if you're going to be prosperous and you're going to be preserved in your prosperity, that means spiritually preserved in your prosperity, that you won't become haughty, you know, from your prosperity. That's your being spiritually preserved when you avoid that. Okay, I'm going to jump down here to the just before the next long quotation. Abba Abraham says, if our mind does not orbit, I mean go, it's not encircle as the center, you know, never forgetting about the center. If our mind does not orbit the love of the Lord as its only fixed and unmoving center, that we do, we're active in life, we're always doing something, always moving, but there's a fixed center. So whatever we do, we're always orbiting this fixed center of the love of the Lord. During everything we do and during all our movements of toil, and if our mind does not adapt or reject a given attitude by guidance of the right kind of compass, to coin a phrase, if it doesn't adapt or reject a given attribute, being guided by a spiritual compass that keeps us facing in the right direction or aware of where the center is, the compass of love, then our mind will never possess by struggling in the right way the way of building up that spiritual structure whose designer is Paul. So if we lose the center, all of the activity that we engage in, the activity that we engage in could be to no spiritual purpose, just more and more and more work. Or the activity that we engage in could build up a spiritual structure of virtues. That's accomplished by making sure that we are rightly oriented toward the center and encircling around the center of love, not going off in some direction, you know, where we're totally forgetting about the purpose of all of the work that we do. Make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Centering the mind on the love of God is the purpose of continual prayer. To focus on the divine, page 158, and to continue to progress in cultivating purity of heart, prayer fixes the mind on God, whatever the body may be doing. So the point is being made here that if we are encircling as we're active, moving round and round, doing all the things that we do, and our focus is on the love of God, if we stay in that condition, it makes our work into prayer because it's focused work. Work that has to do with building up our virtues, you know. And we can kind of think back to all the ways that have been described that using material things can build spiritual life because of the fact that we're constantly having opportunities for discernment and detachment. So as we do our work and we're focused on the love of God at the center of things, spiritual detachment and discernment are going to be ways of keeping focused on the love of God as we work. And so our work becomes a path of spiritual advance. That's how I would put it. Constantly praying while at work is probably the best advice one can give to a manual laborer. For the fathers of the conferences, work always meant the hard labor necessary to survive in the desert. So manual labor is easier to pray during manual labor because you can use the mind to focus on prayer while your hands do physical labor. The fact that the mind is mostly at rest during physical labor creates a vacuum that demands to be fulfilled. For many in the world today, this filling is done with a radio or a set of headphones, playing music or talk programs while we're working. The more or less mental vacuum, the relative mental vacuum created during physical labor would be better treated as a spiritual opportunity, a mental space in which prayer can be pursued while the hands are kept busy. To the extent that our work allows it then, seek prayer while pursuing our labors. However, for a large and ever-growing number of people in our society, work has long ceased to boil down to physical labor. The so-called knowledge economy leaves us increasingly bound to desks, telephones, and computers, sometimes thinking for a living. So your mind is busy. You can't pray as easily. And yet, even more, talking for a living. This is, generally speaking, bad news for us as Christians. Mental labor is simply not very conducive. It doesn't make easy a life of continual prayer. We must focus on a lot of other thoughts in order to perform our jobs. And so he's going to talk about that for the rest of this chapter and then make some general concluding remarks. So I'm going to mark that for us to finish next time. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.